officers from enacting 2021 to 2022 because this bill did not get approved last year. So,
and so Senator Jasinski, if it doesn't get approved this year, you'll come back and change the date again. So I appreciate your.
It'll be a brand new bill, so, but we're not going to get to that point.
No, it's all going to be squared away.
This is a budget priority.
Okay, there you go. That's good. Way to feed into the thing here. So, Senator Jasinski.
Go ahead. Okay. Oh, sorry. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 693 is a very straightforward bill that will impact a great impact to the people with disabilities in my community. This bill increases the rate of reimbursement for a Kaplan Woods Care Home, an intermediate care facility located in Owatonna, Minnesota. The facility is a home to residents who have high medical needs and need assistance in daily living. For many of these residents, this facility has been their home for a couple of decades, and the staff that work there have become like family. I don't think I need to preach to this committee. You know what the needs are. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ashley Fredericks, who's here to testify on behalf of the Kaplan Woods Care Home.
Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the community. My name is Ashley Fredericks. I am with the Kaplan Woods Care Home in Owatonna. Thank you for the chance to appear in front of you in support of S5693. Before I start, I would like to also thank Senator Jasinski for support in carrying this legislation. Kaplan Woods is a 16-bed Class B intermediate care facility, one of 118 in the state that care for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Our goal is to provide the same compassionate care and love to each of our residents that a wonderful mother or father would. Many of our residents don't have family members, so we are that family for them. We are known for taking on very challenging individuals with both behavioral and medical conditions and helping them thrive while making positive progress with both health and behaviors. To put the medical care in context, some residents we feed through G-tubes or we need to monitor 24/7 for severe conditions such as diabetes, seizures, or COPD. Some are blind and many have degenerative conditions in addition to mental health challenges. Many of our residents come from other care homes where the sending home gets to a point where they can't or no longer want to take care of that resident. As an example of when our newer residents came on a short-term stay after breaking her ankle in the two-bedroom home she was living in. After she returned to the home post-rehabilitation, she didn't want to get out of bed and at one point stayed in bed for 2 weeks straight, experiencing high anxiety and OCD behaviors, including not willing to go to the restroom in the actual bathroom. Within the first 30 days of being admitted to our facility, she has been flourishing in her new environment from more structure and increased social interaction with peers. She has gone from going to work on an average of 1 day a week to going to work 5 days a week and uses the facilities often. Her self-esteem in regard to walking and in life in general has improved drastically. Her old home was small with narrow hallways, which had made her unsure of herself and her walking. Now she is able to walk longer distances in her home, which has large wide hallways for her to move around and build up that strength. This is just one example of the many success stories we have had serving our residents at Kaplan Woods Care Home. I'm here today to ask for a rate increase so we can continue to serve and be the family and community our residents deserve. Although we serve individuals with very high needs, our reimbursement rate is among the lowest in the state. A rate increase would allow us to hire more skilled staff, increase wages and benefits to the existing staff, and upgrade our aging facility. The work we do is difficult and mostly thankless. We are sworn at, verbally abused, deal with stubbornness, bad behaviors, bad smells, difficult family members, and a mountain of paperwork to document all of it, just to name a few things. We do it because everyone needs care, love, and to live a life of purpose, and that's what we strive for each of our residents. The best analogy I can give you is that this is not just about the cost of care, but this is about the cost of being a family member. We are not just caring for our residents in the facility, but we are there with them out in the community, living life. We are with them when they have to go to the hospital at 1 a.m. or require a trip to the doctor, the dentist, or therapist. We get gifts for them at holidays and work to make their birthdays special. There are so many things that go into what we do. Mr. Chair, members of the community, I'm exceptionally grateful for your willingness to hear our requests On behalf of our entire team, we'd be grateful for your support. Thank you for your time and your consideration.
Well, thank you. Ms. Fredericks, how do you do that, what you do with high need people with one of the lowest rates?
To be honest,
magic? You must have amazing.
We put in a lot of hours. Our staff are very dedicated to our residents. We are all that they have. We currently have staff that are working 60, 70, 80 hours a week just to make sure that their needs are being met. We're doing what we can with the funding that we have to ensure that above all, that their needs are being met before anything else.
Yeah, fine. It's, if anybody wants to see an exemplar, this committee is just full of amazing people, and you're right at the top of the list of the folks who just want to make a difference, and you devote yourself. And some of the prisoners of history with some of the rates, it's just tragic. So I just thank you for what you do. Comments from members? So we're going to lay this over, and you know, hope we can do something. I don't take it to the bank, but you're on my mind. So
thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Senator Westrum, that's laid back over. Senator Uckey, we'll move Senate File 2618. Thanks. By moved. Pantomime. Oh, there you go. Yep. So Senator Weston, welcome to the committee. Nice to have you back. You don't come very often. If you
not
come
too
more often,
often,
we'll put you on the committee.
Yeah,
you
can be a part we of don't ask for a lot, but when we do, we expect
yeah,
a lot to. But.
So Senator Weston, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, I've got one of my constituents will join us by Zoom to explain the need for this bill, but the Senate file deals with a rate increase in one of the homes in western Minnesota, about as far as you can get to the west in our state without being in South Dakota, in the Ortonville area, which is part of Big Stone County in my district. And Mr. Chair, we're just asking for you to give consideration to a rate increase on the low reimbursement that they receive compared to other similar facilities across the state and in rural Minnesota. And so, Mr. Chair, let me ask our testifier to tell you more about their facility and the need for this to help them cover their costs and keep good qualified staff doing such noble work in our communities. As we all know, this is tough work, taking care of vulnerable adults or elderly, and we just want to present that to you as a committee as you consider rate changes for some of these low rate reimbursements in some rural areas.
Thank you. And you have an amendment, Senator Westrum. So Senator Uckey will move that. It looks like it's kind of technical just to make it work. So any questions about that?
Oh, Senator Uckey. That's my understanding too. Oh,
okay. I'll move it. Otherwise
that's
I was
fine.
Getting ready to vote. So
well, that's
it's a good amendment, right?
It's a good amendment. Yeah. Thanks. Any questions about the A1? It's just technical. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Okay. Ms. Carrolls, welcome to the committee. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and committee members, and thank you, Senator Westrum. It's kind of hard to follow up the previous speaker. She gave me all the details, but I'll do my best. So again, much as Mr. Westrum said, we are asking for a per diem increase. You know, of the 118 facilities like Monarch Heights in the state, we are the absolute lowest. We're not one of the lowest. We are the lowest, currently at a rate of $142.09. You know, I could throw at you how much we do. We're a family, because absolutely, without getting emotional, because that's what I do. Basically, we change lives. We're a home. We were created in 1982, Monarch Heights was, and we were a vision from family members from the community to create a home atmosphere and environment, not just another institution. For adults with disabilities, we're not a part of a huge corporation or company. We simply are a vision from our community. So we are licensed for 12 beds. And again, we're the lowest rate. To put it into perspective, we have 20 staff, five of whom have been there for close to 20 years. We support our home by dedication and the support from our community and family. Of the 118 facilities, like I said, we are the lowest. The average per diem rate in the state is $360. So we are very below. We're asking for this rate increase to put us on a level playing field. So that way, when statewide increases happen, it makes a difference for us. I was running numbers because I'm a numbers person, and looking at the past 10 years, there have been various rate increases, which have totaled $8.54 over 10 years. So that's 85 cents a year. On the flip side, our licensing fees have increased, and they've increased by $219.92 a year. So as you can see, you know, we appreciate the increases, but our fees are increasing as well. A rate increase would allow us to provide care for our residents, to provide higher wages for our staff. You know, our staff members could go 5 miles away or half an hour away and get $13, $14 to $16 an hour at fast food places. And we can only offer a starting wage of $10.85 to $11.85. It would allow us to do building improvements. We recently needed to replace the windows. Our facility was built in 1982. We did that by donations and fundraisers. We sold cookies, you know, plain and simple. So I really thank you for the time to listen. This is life-changing, and a per diem increase, simply put, would just allow us a chance to keep making a difference in the lives of our residents. And like I said, six of the residents have lived at the facility since it opened. And we also have a family of three siblings. This truly is their home. And I'm scared to think of what will happen in the future when our ingenuity and creativity kind of run out. So again, you know, if you have any questions, I welcome them, but I really want to thank you guys for your time.
Well, thanks, Ms. Carrolls. And I admire what you do. I talked to Ms. Fredericks just ahead of you, and you're just at the top of my list. You don't have a job, you have a mission. And the only reason this whole system works at all is by the passion and dedication of you. It certainly isn't for the money. This is helpful for me, and I think it's helpful for the committee to remember some of the statewide challenges, and maybe something can happen. So questions from members? All right. Senator Murphy.
I do. Thank you. And thank you for the testimony. And Senator Westrum, thank you for bringing this proposal for Big Stone County. And there are a number of proposals like this on our agenda today. And I, my ears always tune into the language, right? You do this because of mission. It's not for the money. And that is often said about the helping professions, including nursing. And there is definite purpose and mission in nursing, just like there is in the work that we're doing here. But it isn't a substitute for making sure that people are well paid. And I know that's not what you meant. I absolutely know that's not what you meant. But as we look at the proposals today, all of them and the work that we have left to do, and I know you're going to talk about our budget priorities, I do want to continue to raise the very, very important issue of wages as a way to make sure that we're retaining our critical workforce. And as we talk about rates today, that's a part of that, but we have to make sure that if we increase the rates, that it's getting to the workers as intended so that we can actually continue to retain the people like those who have worked such a long time at Monarch Heights. It's a real testament, and I know that's happening all across the state. So I just want to make sure before we get into the nitty gritty of our work in these next couple of weeks that I'm raising that for you one more time. Thank you.
No, actually, I'm grateful. And I think that you picked up on exactly. It's, the Peace Corps pays a little less. But the only reason this works at all is because these individuals care so much for their clientele. So maybe this is a good time to announce that number. I've been working well this, and so Ms. Carroll, you get to be here at the time when we're going to talk about, I don't know what works out for you, but about the topic. And so you clearly have got people that are so dedicated, they're willing to work at less pay than you get probably almost anywhere because they love their staff. And I don't know that how that can go on for very long. And we've had testimony upon testimony since September about places like yours that have not been successful in staying open and serving those families. And it's just crushing to hear about it. Nursing homes, assisted livings, not so much those, but ICFs and group homes and people having to be moved. And so I don't know if you, I'm sure you don't watch this program is amazing to watch, I'm sure. I have real work to do. But so just a couple months ago, we brought out a kind of a rescue plan for $322 million. Including some retention bonuses for your workers, 206,000 workers across the state, which actually costs $206 million. And then some hiring bonuses for people that want to come on board, $1,500, and then $1,500 to you as the employer to cover the training. And then an additional $110 million in a kind of a bonus rate that would go out. Although I'm not sure that's part of you because you're not in DWR, but in the DWRS world. Anyway, so, and we knew that that was just the beginning. It was, I'm not going to use the B word because I'm so tired of it, but it was a very important emergency help for a system in distress. And the governor responded and offered $268 million in a somewhat vague, but ours is kind of spelled out and his is yet to be defined. But anyway, so there's interest there, but everybody said all the time, well, what are you going to do for the long term? And I've been working on this long-term thing since that question came up the first time. And so I'd like to announce that we don't have targets. We have budget priorities. It's a key difference, because if you had targets, then they'd be targets. If you have budget priorities, it would look like a target, but it's a budget priority. Do you understand the difference? Anyway, so the budget priority that we have in this committee altogether is $1.322 billion, another $1 billion in this area. And that seems like a big number until you start trying to buy stuff with it and it becomes a small number. But at this point, it's the biggest number going. And
Mr. Chair, yes. Is that for the 3 years?
Yes, for the 3 years. Yeah, over 20, whatever. Yeah, through 25. So the next 3 years. And it's the new money is actually based on $250 million in this next year and $750 in the tails. So it's real money. And I've had a few feelers out to some of you who are here today. Just what would you do if you had this much? And frankly, I'm open to any idea people can get. When you see some of the things that I'm talking about, we can discuss it even a little more today. And even next time, but we have to get people into the workforce. There's only 6,000 people in the workforce chart who are ready to come and be nurses and doctors and policemen and working in group homes. So we have to find people that are disinterested, unemployed people, underemployed people, people who could be drawn in to the passion exhibited by these last two program managers. And so if you can help me conjure something into workforce, reaching into I've got a couple urban ideas that I'm gonna work on. We talked about SUD before, how can we get them going? How to be more intentional with our other programming to draw people into the workforce, because the future is not being on a program somewhere. There's an impassable glass or steel ceiling once you get to the top of, you know, some rent assistance, childcare, et cetera. But then you aren't going to get out of that track for you or your family. So, and I'm happy to chat with each of you on the committee for sure, and others who have an idea. I just think, anyway, so ICFs are on my mind. I don't know how to deal with that one yet, but I'm trying to work on it. So, Senator Murphy, that's my answer to your question. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that explanation. and for the information on a budget priority. And then a follow-up question to Senator Benson's question. So this is to cover the rest of this fiscal year and the next biennium. Are there limitations then going forward? Is this one-time funding just for those 3 years? Are we thinking about something more sustainable?
No, there's good question, Senator Murphy. No, it's real money, it's tails. For instance, the governor's PCA proposal, I haven't seen that. I just need to see the tails in 26, 27 on some of these proposals. There's something I wanted to do cost $68 million for DWRS, and then it ballooned to half a billion in 26 and 27. Those are called asterisks, and we can't do asterisks, but if it's kind of straight line, moving along, normal, that's what I think we're going to try to do. And I do want to enlist the help of the committee in ideas. And maybe you haven't thought, like, what would mobilize some, you know, urban people who are not fully engaged in the workforce to want to do that. We need them. And how do I help people want to work part-time, maybe through some of their programming that they're doing? We need them. And so everything in the bill is going to be, there's a few exceptions, but it's going to be, I mean, it's a worksheet. It's not even done. But if you can help me with some ideas, I am all ears about that. So to the public, my email is public. So Ms. Carrolls, you got our attention again. Ms. Fredericks, you were amazing. Senator Westrum, do you want to do a closing thought?
Mr. Chair, I'm just glad to be able to participate in the discussion here. As you've heard, the great work that's going on in Monarch Heights, in Big Stone County, and elsewhere. Just remember, we're at the bottom. The only silver lining of being at the bottom is you can only go up. And so, Mr. Chair, members, I would ask you to help us go up and not be at the bottom. And whatever you can do, we greatly appreciate. But it's kind of like a sports team. Sometimes I've consulted teams that haven't done so well, kind of come out with a losing season. And that's what I always tell them. The only benefit is you can only go up from here. So, Mr. Chair, members, remember that as you're keeping Monarch Heights in this bill and your contemplations with your committee. And Mr. Chair, I'm going to sidestep another issue to bring in when you're talking about employment. Something I've always been an advocate for many years is employment for persons with disabilities. And I tell groups and chambers and others and anybody looking for employees, sometimes that's an overlooked class. And anybody looking for employees should also be sure we're looking for persons with disabilities that are eager and great employees and very capable and doing many, many jobs. And so that's something we need to also think about. How do we incentivize and make sure there's no cash cliffs or disincentives in certain daily rates or needs, supports that some persons with disabilities may need just to get dressed and just to function each day, but they also have an eagerness to work and the gratitude that comes from that. And so that's a group of employees we need to also find ways to engage and re-engage into the workforce as we have such a workforce shortage. I think it's a great opportunity for a lot of things that maybe have been overlooked at times.
So Senator Weston, with that speech, that's almost like an acceptance speech to join the committee. So thank you for coming. It was a very good hearing. So thank you so much for being
very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm missing another committee right now, so I better get back.
Oh, you better go back. Yeah, escape while you can. Senator Benson, do you want to go to the table or do it from your chair? All right. And so while she's moving, Senator Murphy and others, I'm interested in using some TANF to try to get rid of the 50%, earn a dollar, lose 50 cents piece. I would like to put $30 million a year into that and find a way to make it to and help you sort that out. I want to do some MAEPD to help people, anybody who can come into the workforce, to stay there and not be driven out by $100 disincentive or something. So anyway, thank you. Senator Benson, welcome to the committee.
Senate
File 3136.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move Senate File 3136 to be before the committee, and I'd like to move the A1 amendment as an author's amendment.
Alrighty, Senator Benson moves the A1, and let's just vote on that. All in favor, say aye. Aye. Opposed. Alrighty.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Mr. Chair, and especially you and Senator Hoffman are very familiar with AMRTC and the whole committee with community behavioral health hospitals. What happens is counties pay for care for residents of that county at these two facilities. But then if someone no longer needs, the care is taken care of by the state. No, I apologize. I was right the first time. Counties cover the cost. But when a person no longer needs hospital level care and should be moved to another facility, the counties are stuck paying when they have no way to move a client on. So for example, if someone completes treatment at AMRTC and should be at St. Peter, and the state doesn't have a bed available at St. Peter, they charge the county, I believe the number is approximately $1,600 per day for that client when the county has no ability to move the client to another facility. So what this bill does is instead of the county being 100% responsible, the state becomes 100% responsible. Let's be clear, the state is the one that makes all the decisions in these circumstances, who gets placed where, who no longer needs hospital level of care, but the counties pay. So the person with the least ability to act, the entity with the least ability to act, is held financially responsible. And so Minnesota statute states that counties are 100% responsible for the aforementioned cost of care at AMRTC and CBHHs when it is clinically appropriate for the client to be discharged. The client no longer needs hospital level of care, but if they had been civilly committed, mentally ill and dangerous, they have to go to St. Peter. If there are no beds in St. Peter, the person cannot be discharged and the person cannot be moved to St. Peter. And the state has all the control.
Right.
And they get $1,600 per day per person.
I have a friendly amendment to your bill. I think rather than general fund, it could come out of, if they can't find a place, it should come out of DHS admin. They would scoot right along and find
that would be, place. You know what? I would consider that a friendly amendment, Mr. Chair, because they're telling me it's going to cost about $3.7 million of biennium.
Well, if you put that amendment on next Tuesday, we can actually carry the bill with us.
Okay. And then it'd be no cost.
Right. No cost.
That would be, I don't mean to be snarky, but we have been coming, Mr. Chair, trying to figure out how to get people out of AMRTC and into appropriate facilities when there's no capacity.
Right.
And so this is even more narrow than I think the charge last time we brought a bill was $30 million. We've narrowed this down a lot. And with that, Mr. Chair, I do have testifiers who can speak to this more eloquently than I can.
Thanks. And if the testifiers can go like a minute or two each, we kind of understand the thing. But Ms. Larson, you've come all this way through Zoom probably. But anyway, welcome to the committee. Or are you here in person? All right.
No, Amanda.
Welcome.
Hi, Amanda.
Hi, good morning
for being here.
Or good afternoon. I'm sorry. Thanks for laying me up here via Zoom. I appreciate that. My name is Amanda Larson, and I serve as the Health and Human Services Director for Sherburne County. So I am testifying today on behalf of Sherburne County, MICA, the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and MACSA, Minnesota Association for County Social Service Administrators. As Senator Benson said, counties are responsible for paying 100% of the cost of care when individuals are in state hospitals but no longer need that hospitalization level of care. We call that DNMC, so it does not meet medical criteria. So for individuals who are committed as mentally ill and dangerous, they're not being released out in the community. And so while medically they may not meet certain criteria for hospitalizations, counties have no ability to effectuate a transfer to a bed at St. Peter. As it's in their state-operated facilities. So to give you an example, in my county, Sherburne County had an individual placed at AMRTC on December 24th, 2020. On May 24th, the person was declared ready for discharge at AMRTC. However, this person still needed treatment, and MID, MIND petition had already been filed in April. So as soon as this person was declared BNMC, it started the county clock for 100% county pay, as we had already determined that this person was not appropriate to be released back in the community and was awaiting a bed at St. Peter. So finally, on December 29th, 2021, this person was transferred to St. Peter, and it cost Sherburne County property taxpayers $339,122 per day as we awaited for a state bed to accept him. So this one individual remained at AMRTC for 219 days at a cost of $1,600 per day.
So Ms. Larson, so how many of these cases do you have a year? Like just this one? Are they kind of random?
Yeah, so this is the first for Sherburne County, and for a while, my colleague in Stearns County had one that was 88,000. Hennepin County had one that was 420,000. So while, again, as Chair Benson or Senator Benson said, the scope is narrow, but when they hit a county, they hit a county hard. To give you a little bit of perspective, for Sherburne County, my regional treatment center budget for 1 year is $375,000. So this one placement effectively doubled what was paid out in our overall costs.
That's amazing. So maybe there's a dozen or 15 of those based upon the, it's probably in the fiscal note. Well, that's helpful. Thank you. And then the other person you want to testify, Senator Benson, is Mr. Adelson. Is that right? There's some other people that are for backup. Okay. Mr. Adelson, if you can do a minute or two and tell us what you want to tell us.
Good afternoon.
Why don't you find a place for these folks? Here you go. How's that?
Absolutely. Thank you, Chairman. Welcome. Abler. So DCT fully supports what this bill is intending to resolve, which is to remove the cost of care for mentally ill and dangerous patients who've been awaiting transfer from Anoka to Forensic Mental Health. We understand the financial burden this places on counties who have limited options for this patient population. And the department has longed for options to relieve counties from the cost of care. However, patients that remain in the hospital under statute were required to charge for hospital level of services. So despite the administrative review criteria being signed into law in 2020, we've never had any statutory authority to overturn those costs in these circumstances until potentially now. So for these things, we're very excited about. However, while the department supports the intent, we are concerned about some potential unintended consequences, primarily that if passes could impact the number of individuals we serve at AMRTC, and here's why. First of all, we have a fixed number of beds, and our ability to transfer patients from AMRTC into forensics is dependent on our ability to transition individuals out of forensics. So forensics, built over a century ago as the asylum for the dangerously insane, has a title that has aided in the processual precedence that individuals that are served there should remain in state custody indefinitely. For an example, there currently is a patient who has been there for 42 years. So with all due respect to the public safety concern, which is real, the perception is in contrast with the recovery and impacts our throughput. Thus, our beds at forensics are full, and the waiting list for patients waiting to get into a bed there also continues to grow.
So how long is the waiting list?
There are 20-ish individuals currently on, or 24, thank you, individuals on the waiting list currently.
All right,
that's and individuals in the community will take precedence to individuals at AMRTC, right? So if someone's in an unsecure setting, those will be admitted before individuals here.
All right.
So in the meantime, the patients clearly mentally ill and dangerous are waiting transfer from AMRTC to forensics are taking up beds here for those here at Anoka.
Right.
For those who
need. So none of them. We're just running out of time here, but none of those MIND folks are running at large. They're sitting somewhere for safekeeping. Is that correct?
Correct. All right. And here's where we really it's so great to hear. Our previous two items on the docket today, looking at how we really support individuals that are on the front lines of this work. So our nursing, certified nursing assistants, our home health aides, our group homes, all of these individuals are the backbone of our industry. And they're doing some of the hardest jobs while managing incredibly challenging patients all through a pandemic to boot, and for wages that have stagnated for two decades. So as this committee is aware, this is a chronic problem that's further fueled by a pandemic and has reached a point where our programs that we need to discharge people to are closing as they're not able to fill the positions at the rates they're able to offer based upon reimbursement.
Right, I got that. Welcome to the
club. Mr. Chair.
Senator Benson, do you want to wrap up? Go ahead.
Clarification. So staffing at group homes is what's keeping people in the forensic system in St. Paul? Because that seemed to be what he said.
Meaning a safe and viable placement is a part of the barriers that we face and individuals leaving forensics. That is correct.
So Senator Benson, do you want to, that's an interesting question. Do you want to expand
on that? So, and Mr. Chair, he was happy to take us completely off topic. The fact of the matter is the state has control of both sides of this equation and the county's paying for it.
Oh, I get that.
And but so let's refocus on how we give some relief to people who have no ability to effectuate change. The counties for this category of individual cannot say we will find them an alternative placement. Right. They are simply prohibited.
No, I agree. It's
unfair. Finding alternative placement regardless of staffing. And so the state should take responsibility for it.
Got it. And so so we have a pipeline issue as well, which is why they're backed up charging all this money. So so another time, Mr. Adelson, we'll talk about that, but I think it's a worthy discussion. It just is simply unfair. Just to point out, when this, I was around when this came out the first time, and I think it was going to save $4 million, this whole niche. I think it's $16 million a year now or something. So a cautionary note to counties and to the department and chairman in the future, if you're going to save $4 million by doing a share somewhere, it needs to be capped at that share, because the committee at the time needed $4 million with no thought to the tails. This is probably just 444. And so now it became 4, 12, 16, and now you got to buy back to 16 when you're the chair and you haven't got the money. So Senator Benson, last word.
Thank you, Mr. Right. Chair. That's all I've
got. So that's laid over. Senator Wicklund. Senate file 4151. And while you're coming, you weren't here for the announcement, but you can go up there. But so we announced that our priority budget. Yeah, we don't have targets. We have priority budgets. We went through that at some length. But anyway, so this committee has another $1 billion in workforce related money to spend over 3 years for a total of $1.322 billion. So okay. On that cheery note,
oh.
So and help us do that. So anyway, but this is maybe part of that. But anyway, Senator Wicklund, maybe are we doing that 10 minutes on this all together? So go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for hearing this bill. Senate file 4151 was brought to me as a bill that modifies the language around Minnesota certified community behavioral health clinics. The CCBHCs started as a new model of delivering integrated behavioral health care to Minnesotans. It was originally built under a federal demonstration project, and now the model is a benefit under medical assistance in Minnesota. And it is due to our work in the legislature for supporting this over the years. And as the model has evolved, we've needed to make changes, and I've brought bills myself in other years to do that. So this bill is the next step that needs to happen in the evolution of this model. It was designed to be a vision to be a one-stop shop for all eligible clients to receive integrated community mental and chemical health services. There's care coordination and streamlined supports from our mental health system. This is opposed to clients and providers having to navigate our fragmented systems for care. However, there is no single statutory or regulatory authority today that recognizes all the CCBHC services and requirements under one integrated clinic entity. CCBHCs are currently required to demonstrate they have all the underlying state-required licensures or certifications, as well as comply with unique CCBHC standards before they can be certified as a CCBHC. These current standards have conflicting timelines and documentation requirements. As a result, clinics and clients are spending more time and energies in compliance and administrative work, not less. This translates to increased costs and time for providers that are already strapped under the ongoing pandemic and workforce crisis. This bill seeks to take steps to streamlining the model's requirements as CBHC grows and evolves in Minnesota. And before I move to the testifiers here, I do have an A1 amendment.
Yeah, so why don't you move this? Senator Wicklund moves to A1.
I'd like to move the A1.
Is that kind of a rehash of what you said? It's an author's amendment.
It is. It's a delete everything. And right. It is.
Let's just adopt that. It's online. So all in favor of the A1, say aye. Aye. Opposed. And is there a policy component to this, or is it all tied to money? Do you know?
I thought it was all policy, but.
Well, we'll sort that out later.
Yeah,
we're going to lay it over for now. And if you can salvage policy out of this that doesn't necessarily have money, I'm happy to help with that. So.
Yeah, and hopefully the testifiers can maybe speak to that. I think Ginny Palin would be able to speak to that part of it. But first, I would like to have Ashley Chose, who's the CEO of Woodland Centers, to offer testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Chose, is it? In just a couple minutes. Welcome to the committee.
Yeah, thank you so much, Chair Abler, members of the committee. I'm Ashley Chose, CEO of Woodland Centers. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 4151 for the CCBHC policy changes. Woodland Centers, if you're not familiar with us, is a private nonprofit mental health center. We were established in 1958 and we serve 7 rural counties in West Central Minnesota. We serve approximately 5,000 individuals every year that range in age all the way from toddlers to the elderly. And we have a really diverse array of services that includes 6 different licenses and 7 different certifications. And it's a whole range of different services from therapy, med management, substance use, crisis services, CTSS, mobile, and now most recently, CCBHC. Woodland Centers was able to become certified as a CCBHC under the state plan amendment just a few short months ago in January 2022. And we are now one of 12 CCBHCs in the state of Minnesota. And it's anticipated there's gonna be a number of other clinics seeking this certification across the state. And I also want to thank you and the rest of the legislature for supporting the CCBHC model of care. It's really changing our landscape of behavioral health across our state. Woodland Centers gravitated towards CCBHC as it's clear that this model of care surpasses our standard fee-for-service system. It creates true integration of services by evaluating the entire individual, their physical, emotional, substance use, and social determinants of health. It reduces our silos in our healthcare system, ensures better access to services, allows care coordination activities, which is the linchpin for the entire model of care. And without CCBHC, clinics like Woodland Centers would not be able to provide care coordination activities as it's not supported under the state, under the standard fee for service care models. However, there are challenges within the current structure of certification. There's no single regulatory authority for the entire CCBHC model. And instead there are current statutes that are required to have various statute and regulatory oversights, including 4 different certifications and 2 different licenses. These standards have conflicting requirements, which are challenging to navigate and really leave more questions than answers as we attempt to create processes to improve our care and to improve outcomes as a CCBHC. This, in the end, translates to increased costs and time for us as providers when we're already strapped for ongoing pandemic and workforce crisis. When a problem is found or a change is required, CCBHC providers are forced to inform various licensing and certification bodies at DHS, leading to a lot of time and energy navigating the system to determine who exactly needs to be informed of what in order to problem solve or make needed changes. By moving to 1 standard license for CCBHC, providers would have a clear line of communication to licensing so that we could be more efficient in our work. Moving to 1 license as a CCBHC would also save time and money for DHS. DHS is required to complete site visits and audits for each of our individual licenses or certifications every 1 to 3 years. Site visits or audits usually require 2 DHS staff to be on site at our clinic for 2 to 3 days just to review 1 of these programs. So in any given year, Woodland Centers could have 3 to 5 audits, which equates to 6 to 10 DHS staff, 6 to 15 days of travel and hotel stay, and additional expenses related to travel. If we combined all of this into a CCBHC license, Woodland Center site visits would reduce by nearly half every 2 to 3 years. And that's just our site. Sure. And that would save us time and money as well as DHS.
Okay.
I just also want to be
clear. Yeah, just wrap it up, please.
So, yeah.
You're doing great, by the way.
I just want to be clear that Senate File 4151 is not an attempt to reduce oversight by DHS or ensure standards of care are not being met. It's really meant to just combine the different licenses and certifications into one fully encompassed license so that we'd have well-trained DHS staff come in and provide us oversight to our entire system of care. It reduced the administrative burden, and it's really similar to other efforts to reduce administrative burden, including the DHS-led universal service standards and the substance use disorder paperwork reduction effort. It's just another effort to increase efficiency and effectiveness. And as we grow this model in Minnesota, it's really going to be important to have clear, achievable, and sustainable requirements. So I'm really asking that you all please support the passage of Senate File 4151 to help us increase access and improve the CCBHC model of care.
Super. I was smiling when you talked about staffing at DHS and how it's going to save money. Ms. Palin, did this get a fiscal note in the House or anything, do you know, or do you have any estimate about what the cost might be?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm Jinlee Palin with the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And we're currently having some discussions with the department around what they think that fiscal note may be. We're hearing that there is some internal resource needs to carry out some of these policy changes.
Just to remind them, hello out there, DHS fiscal people. Ms. Bailey, how you doing? Mr. Freeman, this is going to save massive amounts of staff, massive, like incredible amounts. It's going to cut it down from last to a normal number. And so could you please include that when you do some of this analysis? I know you need FTEs everywhere else, you know, in such critical ways. Right, Senator Hoffman? I mean.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes,
yeah.
That's true. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, anyway, Monarch Heights has got no problems compared to the problems you need with staff. Anyway, so Ms. Palin, is a lot of this policy, and if we did pass the policy, would that make it worse for you without having the money to go with it? I'm just curious how much money it might be. I mean, a ballpark, are we talking, you know, 10 million, 1 million? You have an idea?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think in terms of what the fiscal note total would be, I'd really have to defer to DHS, but I can say that our intention with the language within the amendment is that it is intended to be policy changes toward the model.
Yeah.
We're not asking for appropriations or increase in rates or anything within this bill.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. And I actually appreciate it. So this came from your coalition or consortium about ways to streamline the whole business of it. And I just, you know, I as one person here appreciate it when a group will take the time to say, how can we make it better? And I urge DHS.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We really would love your support. This, we really believe that CCBHC is a foundational new way to make sure our services are made more accessible, especially as we're facing a mental health crisis, both across adults and children. And so we're really seeing this as a huge potential, and we would really love your support to keep the model moving forward.
Yeah. Did the House request a fiscal note, do you know?
Mr. Chair, the House has not requested the fiscal note, and we are currently working with the House on the best next steps for moving it forward in the
House. Yes, you have, but this is new, this piece here. So maybe we should, Mr. Albrecht is gone, but just remind us that we're waiting many fiscal notes from DHS, and I'd hate to clunk it up with more, but if we can, we'll try to carry this on Tuesday. So Senator Wicklund kind of keep nagging somebody to, I just need a ballpark. If it's, mm-hmm. if it's 50 grand, which nothing is that cheap there. Mm-hmm. But if it's a small amount of money, I have a minuscule amount of money for projects like this, not related to the workforce parts. Senator Wicklund, closing comments.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate right. getting hearing, and I hope that we can find a way to support it.
All right, thank cool.
you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Late over. Thanks a lot. Senator Housley, do you wanna come to the table? And Ms. Cullen, welcome to the committee. And is anybody else in person here, or are other folks robotically on Zoom? Senator Hoffman.
Notice that YouTube lost your audio and wanna
what?
Make sure it's back. Would somebody wanna double check that? I just got a note from people. Like, there are people that actually watch.
So if I talk louder, would that work?
Maybe, I don't know. I just want to let you know that, because you know you are the number one watched committee. In
yeah,
the
we don't want to. No, it's just a pantomime committee. Senator Housley, welcome to the committee. Senate File 3195.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to hear this bill. Senate File 3195 is a bill to help our long-term care providers address the critical staffing shortages with permanent solutions. You will find in your packet a handout where it says 78% of Minnesota nursing homes are now limiting admissions, and the primary reason cited was insufficient staff to meet the residents' needs. 15 nursing homes in Minnesota have closed their doors since 2019, including three in 2022 alone. As you heard earlier this year, these shortages, nearly 20% of the total workforce in long-term care, are impacting seniors and their families' ability to find senior services in communities across the state. This bill adds more wage costs to the facility-specific cost-based portion of the rate. It also applies a known cost change factor to nursing home rates to mitigate the effects of the 21-month delay for increased costs during periods between cost report submission and rate determinations. It also converts the EW and disability waiver customized living rates fully to a new rate system, and it also provides upfront funding for nursing facility wage increases. We do have an author's amendment, Mr. Chair, and since I'm on the committee, I would like to offer the A1 amendment just to get the bill in the shape that I want it to.
Thanks. You want to move your amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move the A1 amendment.
Did you explain that already?
Yep.
I apologize, I was goofing off.
That's okay. I know, trying to up your YouTube watchers. the A1 amendment will replace the placeholder language in section 20 to add a distribution methodology in the funding amount for the nursing facility wage increases. So that's the A1 amendment that I would like to move, Mr. Chair.
Any questions about the A1? Oh, Senator Murphy. You actually read the A1, Senator Housley. I want to.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Senator Housley, thank you for bringing this. And I'm wondering if you or your testifiers could just explain the mechanics of it, because yes, it was adapted in the House.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I have with me Patty Collin, the CEO of Care Providers of Minnesota.
Ms. Collin, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members, Patty Collin, President and CEO of Care Providers of Minnesota. We did work with the Department of Human Services on this amendment. The initial language in that section was more or less of a placeholder until we could figure out the mechanics. Unfortunately, we still do not have the fiscal note on what this amendment would do, but the primary purpose of it was to really put the methodology in place to be able to give the increases. And there's probably going to be another technical amendment added as we're working back and forth with the department on the accountability portion of that. They had a little bit of concerns, and we exchanged language just this morning. So there'll likely be another little amendment to that language.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Ms. Cullen. And I'm just wondering if, as you've worked on this, especially in the House, and now coming over here, if you're talking with the organizations that represent the workers, or if you're primarily working with the Department of Human Services.
Ms. Cullen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy. For the most part, we've been working with the department. I know my colleague, Toby, who's not here, has likely had other conversations with his friends from SEIU and other places.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Cullen. And Toby is a good conversationalist, and I appreciate that. And we'll follow up.
Thank you. And Ms. Cullen, did you discover that the department might need more FTEs or a consultant to bring this to closure, or do they think they can kind of get it worked on by themselves, do you think? That's actually a facetious question. So never mind. All in favor of the A1, say aye. Aye. Opposed. The 57 steps to get a grant out. Senator Housley, to your bill.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I pretty much went over what was in the bill. Okay. And so now we might as well go to my testifiers. And I think Ms. Cullen has more to add to the bill.
So we might as well.
And then I have some more.
Might as well listen to Ms. Cullen. So it's good to have you back in person.
Oh, and it's great to be back. It's like riding a bike. You just never forget, right?
Yeah.
Again,
it's springtime.
It is sort of. Patty Cullen, President and CEO of Care Providers of Minnesota, one half of the long-term care imperative. And I'm just going to reiterate a few of the needs. You've already had a larger hearing on the topic, but I just want to refresh a few of the data points, and then my colleague Aaron will go over some of the specifics on the sections. In the handouts, we also gave you some information about the number of open positions. We have done some current surveys that reinforce the 20% of our workforce continues to be vacant. We are also continuing to lose more employees than we're able to bring in, about 1.25 more resignations than new hires. Every time you see something in the newspaper of Target or someone else increasing their wages and adding schooling, it's a competition for many of our direct care positions. We also know that we've been entering a period of time where our occupancy has been at record lows for a couple of big reasons. One, we had to stop admissions. When you stop admissions because you don't have the staff, the occupancy declines. And also the real fact of the impact of the pandemic on our occupancy early on. We are growing our occupancy slowly, but we have a system that's based on having 90% but better occupancy, and we're right now at 70 some percent. That has a huge impact on our cash flow. We also know, as Senator Halsey mentioned, about the limitation on admissions. We kind of caused a problem with the hospitals in the height of the Omicron because we couldn't take admissions from hospitals, which backed them up, which caused the state to have to look at alternatives. We also know our assisted living had to limit admissions as well. And so it's not just that. We have, when you have an organization named Care Providers in Minnesota and people Google care providing, you get us. We had a lot of calls from family members who couldn't place their loved one. They were at wit's end in their community, and they'd call us and say, my local nursing home said no. Can you make them take my mom? Can you make them take my dad? Very difficult. Cash flow, because you don't have occupancy to have the money come in, and you have increased expenses, far more expenses than you ever anticipated. That's been another huge issue for us. We know that we have folks that have 40% of them said if they missed one payment from the state, they wouldn't be able to cover payroll. And I think another 30% said maybe 1 month. The unanticipated ongoing pandemic expenses of PPE and testing is astronomical, to the hundreds of thousands of dollars. So those are some of the things that are not tied to staff, but let me tell you that some of the other increased expenses have been having to pay pool staff, supplemental nursing agencies, bonus wages, overtime, just to keep your doors open. So that's describing the problem. Aaron's gonna talk about the solution.
Well, Ms. Cullen, while you're just are here to cheer us up, it's not even funny. It's just so sad. How are you doing on the closures of nursing homes? How many have closed like in the last 3 months? Do you know?
This is my closure list, which I keep a running total since 2000. Since February, there have been four. And we know that that's not it. It's not easy.
February, this is
March. February of this year. Yeah. So we had one in February and two in March, one in April.
Okay. And how many closed in the last half of last year? Do you know? Just roughly, I mean, 10 or? We mentioned it at a hearing, there were a couple.
Five closed in 2021.
All right.
And then two more in 2020 since the pandemic.
Yeah. Well, we don't have to go very far into that, but it's on our mind, and this committee of any committee has truly concerned about that. So anyway, so maybe we can do something with our little pot of money. Although it would take almost all the money just in your niche to bring you up to a wage that would be competitive with Target. That's the massive challenge. Anyway, Ms. Hooper, do you have something you can say that will, so just the highlights of the bill, we don't need the weeds, just the overview, and then cheer us up somehow. Thanks.
I will try my best, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Erin Hubert. I am the Vice President of Advocacy for Leading Age Minnesota, and also here as part of the Long-Term Care Imperative. In essence, the bill will provide solutions we need to recruit and retain staff on a longer-term basis, as well as stabilize the operations of our services. So Senate File 3195 will be able to provide permanent increases in staff wages, retain, recruit staff in all areas, not just direct care. We lost a significant number of staff in our dietary and housekeeping areas as well during COVID and are struggling to fill those positions due to wage competition, as others have testified today, particularly for employers who don't have a 24/7 workforce, who don't have, I think, the calling and service that is, I think, required for people who work in senior care. It's just very attractive to go to retail service. 3195 also provides critical increases to the Elderly Waiver Program, which serves seniors through our home and community-based services. The inadequacy of the EW rates in assisted living has been confirmed by DHS in a 2019 study. So the bill would fully implement the rate system that was passed in 2017 and apply the customized living components to waiver clients receiving the service, which I understand is the customized practice and historical practice. We know that the state saves money on each Medicaid beneficiary who can be served in assisted living instead of a nursing home. And so we do really encourage and ask for your investment in the elderly waiver along with nursing homes. This year, Minnesota became home to 1 million seniors. We have all known that this milestone was coming for years, and we have been partnering with lawmakers to meet the needs of our growing population over the last few years. Senate File 3195 takes critical steps to address these needs by investing in wages for caregivers. We really would like to thank you for all of your ongoing support for professional caregivers through the past 2 years of the pandemic, and for the emergency measures that were able to bridge us between then and this legislative proposal. We recognize that this is not a budget year. We do appreciate the newly announced budget priority this afternoon, and we can't wait until the next legislative session for relief. So we thank Senator Housley for sponsoring this legislation, and we really thank you for your support.
Well, thanks, Ms. Hooper. You better hope we don't spend all the money if you want some hope for next legislative session. So. But absolutely, there's going to be some kind of a piece from part of this. Do you know how much the elderly waiver fully funding the framework costs? Ballpark? I'm just curious, is it 100 million or is it 50?
Mr. Chair, if you wish, I believe we have some of our financial technical experts available via Zoom if you would like to ask them that question.
I don't know if we'll take the time for that, but I'm just, maybe they can send me an email or something. So. And so we're very much interested in this. And so I'm going to we don't have bills up on every topic, but you know, DWRS, PCA, kind of do something for the ICFs, every major cluster of that going on, home care, kind of on the workforce side, especially on the lower end. You know, it's hard to, anyway, it's just a billion seems like a lot, but it goes. So that's helpful. Senator Housley, do you want to, any questions from members? Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously, an important issue for this committee. And like everybody else, I am sure you have visited with people who work in assisted living or long-term care in the last couple of years. And I was recently to a facility in the district I represent. While I believe that money is an important factor, especially when we think about retaining a workforce, a skilled workforce. What I heard from the director of nursing and from the leadership of the facility I visited was a very profound and painful story about what they've experienced over the last couple of years. And workers leaving because they could no longer bear what they were experiencing in terms of loss. So I do want to raise, in addition to this issue of funding, the idea that working conditions are a factor. Things like paid leave or earned sick and safe are important for these employees. And an issue that I've been working with Senator Benson on, which is making sure that there is adequate funding for peer support and mental health and recovery for the people who have, you know, endured these last couple of years and significant losses as a result is a part of what I think we should be paying attention to as we move forward. And I just want to share that with you as well, that there is
the retention of workers with wages so they can compete, but also a recognition that people have been through a lot and we should pay attention to that as well. Thank you.
That's a very point very well taken. I don't know a lot of what to do with that exactly, based upon, you know, all the, I mean, I'm not going to go too far down this track, but the governor's budget for this area was this, blank piece of paper. There was nothing in the budget there for all the discussion. And so we can spend our money how we decide to, but if the point is to retain and attract workforce. And so I don't know what I'm even asking for you to think about, but it's a package. And how do you get workers to stay? I would love that they get out benefits and that they get out, you know, the kind of things that some of the bigger companies can offer. But and unfortunately, almost all the money that goes into this niche comes from us, the taxpayers. But so anyway, Senator Housley, last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Closing numbers. We've now lost 20 nursing homes to closure since 2019. And we currently have 23,000 job vacancies in this industry. So anything that we can do in this committee that we can support to help our caregivers will have an impact when it comes to an access to safe quality care where our seniors need it. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well said. And I think this is a productive discussion, and at least there's a little light at the little LED light at the end of the tunnel. So with that, it's laid over as amended.
Thank you.
Senator Housley, Senate file 4209. So we're doing pretty good on time, but we just can't get too dragged down. That was a very important discussion last time. So 4209, Senator Housley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's another good bill. 4209 deals with creating an ombudsperson office for foster children. I'm speaking to the critically important issue of ensuring that the children in our state's care, our foster care system, are protected and served just as well as children in our own homes. The Ombudsperson's Office aims to provide oversight for the systems that are tasked with protecting Minnesota's children from harm and create a vehicle that can adequately track the issues affecting young people in Minnesota. This is needed because foster children do not have a resource or an avenue for intervention when they are being abused or neglected at the hands of our own child protective services. As it stands, there are no organizations or entities that track complaints or common concerns that arise for fosters. Without this data, we are left powerless to affect meaningful changes in our existing structures. So how do we make an improvement with this bill? By establishing an ombuds office for fosters, we are creating an organizational structure that will create positive change, allow for more capacity to do independent investigations, and track areas where significant intervention is needed. Navigating the foster care system alone is a challenging task in itself. Without the appropriate tools and advocates, we will continue to fail these children and continue to repeat all this too common cycle that we see in our communities. If passed, this office would positively affect the Minnesota child welfare system. By the child welfare system will experience fewer complaints to county offices. Fosters will experience a more fair process to access resources such as housing. And a separate ombudsperson office will prevent homelessness and other risk factors. I have one testifier, Mr. Chair. I have Wong Murphy with me.
And should we do the amendment?
That's right.
The A1, I'm interested in the, it's changing administrative to a responsible social services.
Yes, so when, Mr. Chair, compared sorry.
Irresponsible, I mean.
Well, prior to the first hearing in the House, the author, Jessica Hansen, amended the phrase from administrative agency throughout the whole bill to align with the language that's already used and defined in Chapter 260C. Which governs child protection matters. So right. The term administrative agency wasn't defined anywhere else, so we changed it.
Let's so Senator Hollis.
So I offer the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Anybody questions about that? All in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed. All right. Well, welcome to the committee. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. It is an honor to be testifying for you today. And thank you, Chair, for making time to hear us. My name is Hwang Murphy, and I'm the founder and executive director of a nonprofit called Foster Advocates. It is not just our name, it's what we do. We foster advocacy with young people who have been impacted by foster care. I founded this work in 2018 based on a really just audacious idea that child welfare systems change could and should be led by people who had experienced foster care. However, I must apologize because while I really wish that I could tell you how great our children are doing and how wonderful our state is at treating them, I can't. Because all the data that we have tells us that we're not doing the best job, not by any measure of success. Upon reaching their 21st birthday, a time when most peers are out celebrating, fosters face a deep stability cliff and they lose all financial and social support networks provided by the state. It's also then no wonder that foster youth often age out at age 18, experience homelessness within, 25 to 40% within a year. And a recent survey done by an org here in the 7 Metro County found that between the ages of 18 and 21 year olds, 79% had been homeless. So when families are not safe places for children to be, the government steps in. But what happens when it is the government that is causing the harm? This begs just a really basic question. Who is watching the watchers? Currently, no one. Children are entrusted to our care, must face the challenges of life on their own upon aging out, and they shouldn't have to face the foster care system alone with no one to call for help. And it doesn't have to be this way. We can do better for our young people. We must do better. Creating more opportunity for the Ombuds Office to lead meaningful change and improve systemic issues plaguing the child welfare system in Minnesota will have a trickle-down effect for the state's child welfare system by anticipating and fixing issues that otherwise may lead to further endangerment of foster youth and also may lead to potential lawsuits for any harm done. Creating an advisory board will allow foster youth to have a real say in what happens and a space to where they can actually put a voice into the system. These are our children. They became ours when we separated them from their families, and we owe them a duty of care just as strongly as we do the children in our very own homes. And the fundamental truth is, children are children. And they deserve and have the expectation that adults should take care of them. I've seen on the personal level, and I'm now seeing on the professional level, that this is not happening. It's my sincerest hope that those of you in power, those of you who are sitting in these chairs today, reflect deeply on our moral responsibility and the cost of our continued indifference. So please support the creation of Office of the Ombudsperson for Foster Youth. And I do just want to note that this has bipartisan support in the House. We just really appreciate the chance to make sure that young people get what they need. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And it's really too bad that it's too bad we need this, but we probably do. And I don't even know we're supposed to be the group that oversees so many of these functions. And we have a lot of we have a very small pulpit here, but some people listen to what we care about, but it's just where in the systems are breaking down is a good question. And I'm not doubting that this is a necessary thing. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And these are the reasons. There's a good friend of mine who said the reasons for government really is about children, our elderly, and people with disabilities, right? And just said, this is the reason. When you look at the children's program on the national level, has always said for years, we don't do enough to assure foster children get the necessary supports when they leave the foster care system. And I saw a picture, I remember, of a cliff and a child falling off. And Mr. Chair, I'm super supportive of this, absolutely. And it reminds me, prior to moving back to Minnesota, yeah, I'm not going to give you a Washington, D.C. conversation because it's not worth it. I served 6 years in a juvenile detention facility. I was a supervisor. I wasn't actually in there. But we oversaw youth that were coming out of shelter care, youth that were coming foster care. There were some, and I'll never forget, the kid's name was Billy. And they opened the door when he turned 18, and he had nowhere to go. A week later, a youth was killed on Interstate I-235 in Des Moines because he was on a bike going down the wrong way of the entrance or off ramp, right? And this just hits me, saying that we don't do enough to support people. I mean, the system fails, and we have these conversations about where the system fails people. Man, this makes sense, Jim. And so if we can find something like that, I thank you for your testimony, and this is the kind of stuff we should really be doing. And to your point, and that's, I just needed to.
No, I we did. So. There's more to that story, but I appreciate that story. And we did a foster person's, what do they call them, Bill of Rights a couple of years ago, and into that. Any other comments from the committee? Senator Housie, I think you're going to civil law with this thing. It's like a data machine here. So.
Is that where I'm going, civil law?
Well, otherwise you're going to sit here. So
I'll
if we move it now, I mean, it's the first, in the first line, it says something, something data. And he reads more, it says data. Then it says court data, and then it talks about other data. So just a random thought. So if for somehow you can weasel out of that, then you can come back here.
Mr. Chair, I'm willing to take the risk to go.
Yeah, I think you want to. But so anyway, the committee report can move tomorrow, and then you have a chance to try to get it over. That's anyway. So we're doing our best to move it along. Heard it early, and away you go. So, any questions about this? Excellent testimony, sir. Thank you very much. So Senator Housie moves that Senate file, whatever the heck this one is, 4209, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Everybody, any questions? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. You're on your way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks. Senator Hoffman. And Senator Franzen's not in the room yet. Just making sure. Senator Hoffman, Senate File 3647, and you've got about 10 minutes start to finish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll be really fast. Chair Abler and members, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 3647. This is that bill that we had talked about that gives the county's discretion to bill families at a cost of out-of-home placement. As you know, the cost of care policies currently require counties to bill families in an attempt to recover costs of caring for their child in out-of-home placements. While this may have been well intended in practice, as you know, it's significant waste of taxpayer dollars, makes it harder for families to reunify with their children, and adds financial strain to families at a time of crisis and piles on debt. As you know, that's that we spent $10.5 million in administrative costs to collect $3 million. Well, that's wise use of government money. But Mr. Chair, this bill, as you know, went to civil law, and you know, we were in and out of there in 5 minutes, and they passed it back to here saying there's a posted note, I think, on your thing there. Senator Matthews said, do not mess with this. We're sending it back. That's supposed to be funny. But with that, I have Trish Skulpheimer and Michelle Koppel here, who are provided the testimony over in civil law. And we're here to answer questions and present to you, Mr.
Well, thanks, and thank you. Otherwise, what, he's gonna sue us? He's a lawyer, right?
Yeah, he's a lawyer. You get these lawyers. It's like
we just make laws, Senator Hoffman. We don't get to do any anyway. So if you could help me understand the expense part of this. So we talked about it offline, and just given the time we have, I'd like to know who spends the money and who's gonna save the money.
The money gets, do you want me to introduce myself first? I'm sure so.
Oh, yeah, please.
The Ramsey County Child Support Services Division. The most of the data that we have is around reimbursement that happens through the child support system specifically. There's not good data that tells us how reimbursement is happening in other places, and reimbursement does happen in multiple ways. Child support's just one piece of it. We also get reimbursement through doing tax intercepts, through direct billing of parents, through redirecting Social Security benefits, just to name a few. But in terms of what comes in through the child support system, study shows that we spend about $10 million in child support expenditures, just operational and staff and things like that. And then the collections that we get come out to about $3,000. So you have child support spending, $3 million.
Oh yeah. Is that for the state or is that for your county?
It's for counties. Counties are doing
87 counties.
Yep. Okay. So counties are doing this spending of the money in the child support budget, collecting the money and then sending it over to their social services budget. So in some counties that's, overseen by the same person.
Is this all county money?
Yes, sir. It is county money. Yes.
So if DHS got the $3 million, they charge us $3 million to save you 10.
Correct.
Well, we don't have to ask him that question.
No.
All right. Is there a state cost on this, Senator Hoffman?
Not that I know, Mr. Chair. There's some things that good old Jennifer Sommerfeld, there's a name for you, is working with Matt Freeman and Trish on. There's some nuances, some 4E stuff in there that doesn't touch civil law, but they're still working on what does that look like, but
Yeah, so Ms. Keppel, you're here. Is that you there? Do you want to say something?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks for being here in person. We're just still basking in the in-person thing here.
Thank you. My name is Michelle Keppel. April 29th, 2014, my son was a victim of a very traumatic event done maliciously and on purpose by a person he loved and we trusted. Prior to this, he was a typical 14-year-old that was obsessed with racing motocross, playing hockey, and was not prone to getting into trouble. He changed almost overnight into an angry young man who hated the world and everything in it. He started getting into trouble immediately and very quickly spiraled out of control. At 16, he broke into a home with two other boys that included the boy that lived there. As a parent who believed in doing the right thing, I forced him to confess right away. The others did not. Ultimately, he was charged with first-degree burglary with extended juvenile jurisdiction, despite having no prior history of theft or any other serious charges. The first night he spent at Washington County Jail, we were given a financial information request form. We submitted the completed form as quickly as we could because that's what you do. After several months of asking, I was told based on our combined household income, we would be responsible for the entire bill for jail. Now, I'm a county employee and my husband was working for the federal government at the time. While we were financially comfortable, we certainly would not be considered wealthy, very middle class. Eventually, we got an estimate for an anticipated 9-month sentence at the Eastern Regional Juvenile Detention Center. It would be either $250 a day, which comes to $7,500 a month, which is $67,500 for 9 months, or $199 a day, which is $5,970 a month, or $53,730 for 9 months. During my son's incarceration, we had a drastic change in my husband's income. Initially, Washington County told us we would still owe the entire bill. I knew from working for Ramsey County, I could request a hearing to dispute what we owed. Instead of letting that happen, Washington County agreed to reevaluate our financial responsibility. In the end, our bill came to $23,000. Add to this thousands in attorney fees and the cost of multiple mental health treatments and psychologists. Only through the sale of our home that we lived in for 12 years were we able to pay everything off. I respectfully request, Senators, that you support this bill so no family has to go through the nightmare that mine did. Thank you.
You have to pay to go to jail?
Yeah.
Yes.
So, I mean, this is a serious thing, but they arrest you I can't pay. Well, okay, see ya. I mean, what if that's just, I'm amazed. I'm so sorry. And so you actually had to write that check or you just?
Yes.
And it's even on top of that, Senator Abler, if I may,
Yeah.
80% of the people that we're collecting from make less than $10,000 a year.
And they have to pay.
They have to pay. So let's just keep this cycle.
It is the end of the world as we know it.
That's a great song from the 80s.
It's...
Yeah. You caught me speechless.
Holy buckets. All right. Well, let's... you can work with Ms. Sommerfeld and...
Oh, yeah.
And this can just be the teeth-dropping part of the bill when you explain it on the floor. Senator Hoffman. This is like the reverse of debtor's prison.
Yeah.
I mean, except you're paying for somebody else's. Holy buckets.
Oh, well, you know, if you really want to get in the weeds, Mr. Chair, if I may, then you can get into
You always
the,
do.
The,
so.
No, I don't. There's Senator permissive Hoffman. And non-permissive language. Thank you, Mr. Chair, right? And so apparently the feds have, you know, an issue with non-permissive or permissive. And we want to just say, you know, should. And they say, well, you shall and you may. Yeah. I mean, there's honest to God, you can't make this up. But in the meantime, did I tell you 80% of the people that were, you know, make less than $10,000 a year that are in this system?
I'm
a efficient
proud of
government
state.
At its finest right there. Mr.
I'm proud
Chair.
Of my state, Senator Hoffman. There's Thank days you. I'm not proud at all of how we run our state. And this yeah. is not a, this is not any party that did this. This is the accumulation of well-intended ideas. I can stack up my books again if you want.
You want to do that? I think
no,
that,
we don't need that, but everybody since
Elmer Anderson
started this, the Anoka guy, and everybody since. And anyway, so
yeah.
This has been thank you for coming, and I'm just so sorry for thanks for speaking up. So maybe somebody else won't have this happen to you.
Thank you.
So did you want to say anything else?
Anything else you want to answer?
I don't think I can add anything that Michelle and Senator Hoffman haven't already said.
It's amazing. This is absolutely amazing. Try to right one wrong at least. Any questions? So Senator Hoffman, this is laid over to get sorted out. And if you can, we'll throw it on the bill on Tuesday.
On Tuesday.
As an amendment. We won't put it in the base. Maybe we'll just see if it's worked out. So we'll just see.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's laid over.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Franson's on her way down. I know we have a testifier. So Senator Murphy will move Senate file 3643. Miss Williams, are you there? I've been kind of interested to hear what I'm eager to hear what you have to say.
Yes, I am. I'm here. Would you like me to come online or wait for Senator Franson?
Well, we're going to run out of time. So just come and she'll catch up to you.
Okay, great.
You can tell us. So the bill is there before us. It's been moved and you know what's in the bill. And so tell us, we've got about, literally 10 minutes. We have to leave the room. So go ahead and in a couple minutes, tell us what you want to tell us.
Yeah, thank you so much, Chairman. My name is Raisha Williams, and I'm a part of an organization called Guns Down, Love Up. We are not an anti-gun violence or gun organization. We do believe in the amendment to be able to carry arms, but we are anti-gun violence. In 2018, my brother Tyrone Williams was murdered in North Minneapolis in front of my mother's home on his way to work. And I, unfortunately, was the last person to see him take his last few breaths of life. And which started my commitment to ending gun violence here in the Minnesota area. Myself, my mother, and many family members all are licensed gun owners. So we understand the responsibility of being licensed, being educated in guns and the usage of guns. But we realize that there is a surge of gun violence taking place across the Twin Cities. And St. Paul alone in the last year, 2,326 reports of shot fires have happened. And since in more than 20 years, there were 200 gunshot victims in St. Paul alone last year. And in Minneapolis, gun violence has increased since the year of 1995 to over 500 shootings and 600 people being treated for gunshot wounds. Gun violence is a public health crisis. It is affecting us all. Whether you live directly in the Twin Cities or you live in the suburbs or surrounding counties, this is trickling out and it will continue to rise. I am asking you to support our bill today to move forward to fund our organization, Guns Down, Love Up. We focus on doing a community at large media message campaign that promotes love, conflict resolution over violence. It is important that we take these measures to move forward and stop putting band-aids on bullet hole wounds. People are dying and they will continue. National studies have showed that across Minneapolis and other states such as Washington, D.C., San Francisco, and Oakland, gun homicides have made home ownership rates and the credit scores go down, decreasing the home values more than $22,000. And also, it shows that a total cost of $63 million in medical treatment has been put into gun violence and gun wounds. We are here to promote conflict resolution through intervention, prevention, and conflict resolution. We have been out in the community since 2018. We are a nonprofit. We have received grants through MDH, DHS, the city of Minneapolis, as well as St. Paul to do this work. And we're really made up of community members who are really committed to this work, but are all volunteers with a few staff members in order to really combat gun violence and to really be able to get out there and push the message and also create programming within the school systems to stop, such as programs like DARE, to get younger people to learn about conflict resolution and stop gun violence ahead of time. So we're asking you to support this bill. I thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman. I thank you everybody for listening to us. And I'm certainly open to any questions.
Thanks, and Senator Franzen's here now. So welcome. I'm just glad you could make it. So
thank you.
Nice you can be here. We've had a very productive day, and now you saved the best for last. So the bill's been moved. We heard a very compelling, actually tragic story from Ms. Williams, and now Senator Franzen, if you would like to say something.
Thank please. You, and thank you, Ms. Williams, for members for hearing this bill. It's an important issue. Violence is a healthcare issue. It's a health issue, and it's plaguing our communities. And we want to make sure that we address it holistically, not just with prevention strategies, but also with the healthcare strategies that we have in place. And I think that's why we ended up in this committee, that we know that this is part of a holistic approach to ending violence in our communities, and a proven strategies like this group with Ms. Williams and Ms. Neville's, who also is part of the group. Just want to make sure that you heard directly from them, and that if there are any questions, that we make ourselves available. But I appreciate the time given to from this committee to this issue.
So, Ms. Williams, we have a few minutes, and we're going to lay this over, there's not going to be a vote. But in a year, how many people would you interact with, do you think, in your group?
Yeah, in our first year, we interacted with 2,000 people. And since then, we've had direct touch and just touch through our message media campaigns of about 8,000. We do a lot of our commercials on the local CW and Xfinity streaming networks that reach about 10,000 each time we relaunch it. But we've had many community members come to our healing circles, our mental health groups, and our community action events to promote gun violence. And we've had the number of about 38,000 over the course of our 3 years of being in existence.
Well, good for you. I'm just sorry about your loss.
Thank you.
So your organization is a singular focus pretty much, right?
Yeah, we're focused on gun violence prevention.
And trying to get people to work things out instead of doing something.
Absolutely. And educating people on the proper usage of guns and education around guns, and mainly doing conflict resolution and how do we resolve conflicts through, you know, mental health practices, through talking, through conversations, before we revert to gun violence as our only option.
And this is not to minimize any, I'm just trying to think, do you have any way to tell if something bad hasn't happened because of your work? I don't doubt for a second that all the people that you've touched are more squared away some way, but
yeah,
I don't know how you measure what doesn't happen, but do you have a thought about that?
Yeah, we have to turn in data that we collect to the city of Minneapolis as well as the city of St. Paul, but there's not a lot of extensive research data on our outcomes or any other gun violence prevention group outcomes. A lot of us have just come online in the last 4 years as the surges of gun violence has happened, but it's one of those, it's an effort that's going to take many different organizations, many different government agencies to really show outcomes and inputs. And so MPD, we work with them as well. Our first grant came from the Minneapolis Police Department to do it. And so it's just, you know, putting in many efforts from many different judicials, community organizations, school systems, just all of us putting our hands on the problem.
Thank you, by the way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Franson for bringing forward this proposal, and Ms. Williams for your testimony. I have heard about this proposal from one of our school board members in St. Paul, school board member Allen. And I hear from a school board member that it is important that we are paying attention to this issue and to prevention. It makes me want to focus very seriously on the intervention and the prevention for our young people. And so I'm grateful that we started this committee hearing today with the announcement that there is budget priority of $1.322 billion. And I sure hope that we can find within that some money for this worthy program for young people. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Franson, last word. And thanks, Ms. Williams, for coming. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for the work, Ms. Williams. Thank you, members and Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill and looking for ways to do things differently, but also to support this and promote it, right? Promote the work that this organization and others are doing in this space. And it's very important as we see a lot of our communities being grappling higher incidence of violence, and we want to make sure our kids are on the right path. And I think this is part of that solution.
Well, thank you very much. Well, I think it's been a productive day. Thursday, we are going to fill it up with more good stuff. So, and then Tuesday is Mark Camp, our omnibus. And so just prepare to go. There's no transportation that day, so we're going to go right through again. And I can't think we're going to go terribly late. But and Senator Franson, you were here. I announced that we have a budget priority in this topic area for workforce for $1.322 billion, including $1 billion that we've not talked about before, tied to workforce. And the crisis in workforce and long-term care, but as it dribbles into other areas as well, and trying to find different ways to reach into sectors that might not be the ordinary sector to draw people in. And so I don't know how we tie that to Ms. Williams' population, but a number of those folks could use some help just to be successful. And so we're talking about a number of ideas all over across the board, ranging from changing the TANF, the MFIP cliff, from losing 50 cents on a dollar to maybe 25 cents, maybe putting $30 million a year of TANF in that, stuff like that to help people draw in. So I have a lot of ideas, but I could use other ideas from other people to get creative, because we have to draw people back into the workforce. That's their success. That's their stability. You get to work, you make good friends, and it just helps, I think. And so that's the best I can think right now. So
glad to hear there's a target.
Yeah. No, it's a budget priority.
Oh, I'm sorry, budget priority.
We don't have targets. Thank you. With that, we're adjourned.